Chapter 9. Domin, Domin, sing we a litany, wail we and weep we a wild miserier. One of the chief beauties of this ballad, for the translation, of which I received some well-merited compliments, is the delicate way in which the suicide of the poor young woman under the willow tree is hinted at, for that she threw herself into the water, and became one among the lilies of the stream, is as clear as a pikestaff. Her suicide is committed sometime in the darkness, when the slow hours move on tolling and tolling, and is hinted at darkly as befits the time and the deed. But that unromantic brute, Van Cutsem, the Dutch charge d'affaires, sent to the Cardofelmkrans of the week after a conclusion of the ballad, which shows what a poor creature he must be. His pretext for writing it was, he said, because he could not bear such melancholy endings to poems and young women, and therefore he submitted the following lines. I, long by the willow trees vainly they saunter, wild rang the mother's screams o'er the gray water. Where is my lovely one? Where is my daughter? 2. Rouse thee, sir constable, rouse thee and look. Fisherman, bring your net, boatman your hook. Beat in the lily beds, dive in the brook. Apostrophe apostrophe 3. Vainly the constable shouted and called her, vainly the fisherman beat the green altar, vainly he flung the net, never it hauled her. IV. Mother beside the fire sat, her nightcap in, father, in easy chair, gloomily napping, when at the windowsill came a light tapping. V. And a pale countenance looked through the casement. Loud beat the mother's heart, sick with amazement, and at the vision which came to surprise her, shrieked in an agony lore. It's Eliza. Apostrophe, Vi, yes, 'twas Elizabeth, yes, 'twas their girl, pale was her cheek, and her hair out of curl. Mother, apostrophe, apostrophe, the loving one, blushing, exclaimed, let not your innocent Lizzie be blamed. Vi. Yesterday, going to Aunt Joan's to tea, mother, dear mother, I forgot the door key. And as the night was cold, and the way steep, Mrs. Jones kept me to breakfast and sleep. Apostrophe apostrophe V. Whether her pa and ma fully believed her, that we shall never know, stern they received her, and for the work of that cruel, though short, night, sent her to bed without tea for a fortnight. X. Oral, hey diddle diddlety, cat and the fiddlety, maidens of England take caution by she. Let love and suicide never tempt you aside, and always remember to take the door key. Some people laughed at this parody, and even preferred it to the original, but for myself I have no patience with the individual who can turn the finest sentiments of our nature into ridicule, and make everything sacred a subject of scorn. The next ballad is less gloomy than that of the willow tree, and in it the lovely writer expresses her longing for what has charmed us all, and, as it were, squeezes the whole spirit of the fairy tale into a few stanzas. Fairy days. Beside the old hall fire upon my nurse's knee, of happy fairy days, what tales were told to me. I thought the world was once all peopled with princesses, and my heart would beat to hear their loves and their distresses. And many a quiet night, in slumber sweet and deep, the pretty fairy people would visit me in sleep. I saw them in my dreams come flying east and west, with wondrous fairy gifts the newborn babe they blessed. One has brought a jewel and one a crown of gold, and one has brought a curse, but she is wrinkled and old. The gentle queen turns pale to hear those words of sin, but the king he only laughs, and bids the dance begin. The babe has grown to be the fairest of the land, and rides the forest green a hawk upon her hand. An ambling palfrey white a golden robe and crown, I've seen her in my dreams riding up and down, and heard the ogre laugh as she fell into his snare, at the little tender creature who wept and tore her hair. But ever when it seemed her need was at the sorest, a prince in shining mail comes prancing through the forest. A waving ostrich plume, a buckler burnished bright, I've seen him in my dreams, good sooth. A gallant knight. His lips are coral red beneath a dark mustache. See how he waves his hand, and how his blue eyes flash. Come forth, thou Paynim knight. ..." he shouts in accents clear. The giant and the maid both tremble his voice to hear. "Saint Mary guard him well," he draws his falchion keen. "The giant and the knight are fighting on the green. I see them in my dreams, his blade gives stroke on stroke. The giant pants and reels and tumbles like an oak. With what a blushing grace he falls upon his knee, and takes the lady's hand and whispers, "You are free." ..." Happy childish tales of knight and fairy. I waken from my dreams, but there's never a knight for me. I waken from my dreams and wish that I could be a child by the old hall fire upon my nurse's knee. Indeed, Attilia looked like a fairy herself. Pale, small, slim, and airy. You could not see her face, as it were, for her eyes, which were so wild, and so tender, and shone so that they would have dazzled an eagle, much more a poor goose of a Fitzpoodle. In the theater, when she sat on the opposite side of the house, those big eyes used to pursue me as I sat pretending to listen to the Zauberflute, or to An Carlos, Ergmont, and at the tender passages, especially, they would have such a winning, weeping, imploring look with them as flesh and blood could not bear. Shall I tell how I became a poet for the dear girl's sake? 'Tis surely unnecessary after the reader has perused the above versions of her poems. Shall I tell what wild follies I committed in prose as well as in verse? How I used to watch under her window of icy evenings, and with chilblainy fingers sing serenades to her on the guitar? Shall I tell how, in a sledging party, I had the happiness to drive her, and of the delightful privilege which is, on these occasions, accorded to the driver? Any reader who has spent a winter in Germany perhaps knows it. A large party of a score or more of sledges is formed. Away they go to some pleasure house that has been previously fixed upon, where a ball and collation are prepared, and where each man, as his partner descends, has the delicious privilege of saluting her. Oh heavens and earth! I may grow to be 1,000 years old, but I can never forget the rapture of that salute. The keen air has given me an appetite, said the dear angel, as we entered the supper room, and to say the truth, fairy as she was, she made a remarkably good meal consuming a couple of basins of white soup, several kinds of German sausages, some Westphalia ham, some white puddings, an anchovy salad made with cornichons and onions, sweets innumerable, and a considerable quantity of old Steinwein and rum punch afterwards. Then she got up and danced as brisk as a fairy, in which operation I of course did not follow her, but had the honor, at the close of the evening's amusement, once more to have her by my side in the sledge, as we swept in the moonlight over the snow. Kalbsbrücken is a very hospitable place as far as tea parties are concerned, but I never was in one, where dinners were so scarce. At the palace they occurred twice or thrice in a month, but on these occasions spinsters were not invited, and I seldom had the opportunity of seeing my Attilia except at evening parties. Nor are these, if the truth must be told, very much to my taste. Dancing I have forsworn, whist is too severe a study for me, and I do not like to play ecarte with old ladies, who are sure to cheat you in the course of an evening's play. But to have an occasional glance at Attilia was enough. And many a Napoleon did I lose to her mama, Madame de Schlippenschlipp, for the blessed privilege of looking at her daughter. Many is the tea party I went to, shivering in too cold clothes after dinner, which is my abomination, in order to have one little look at the lady of my soul. At these parties there were generally refreshments of a nature more substantial than mere tea punch, both milk and rum, hot wine, consommé, and a peculiar, and exceedingly disagreeable sandwich made of a mixture of cold white puddings and garlic, of which I have forgotten the name, and always detested the savor. Gradually a conviction came upon me that Attilia ate a great deal. I do not dislike to see a woman eat comfortably. I even think that an agreeable woman ought to be frightened, and should love certain little dishes and knick-knacks. I know that, though at dinner they commonly take nothing, they have had roast mutton with the children at 2, and laugh at their pretensions to starvation. No. A woman who eats a grain of rice, like Amina in the Arabian Nights, is absurd and unnatural. But there is a modus in rebus. There is no reason why she should be a ghoul, a monster, an ogress, a horrid gourmandizer, a spa. It was, then, with a rage amounting almost to agony, that I found Attilia ate too much at every meal. She was always eating, and always eating too much. If I went there in the morning, there was the horrid familiar odor of those oniony sandwiches. If in the afternoon, dinner had been just removed, and I was choked by reeking reminiscences of roast meat. Tea we have spoken of. She gobbled up more cakes than any 6 people present. Then came the supper and the sandwiches again, and the egg flip and the horrible rum punch. She was as thin as ever, paler, if possible, than ever. But, by heavens, her nose began to grow red. Mon Dieu, how I used to watch and watch it. Some days it was purple, some days had more of the vermilion. I could take an affidavit that after a heavy night's supper it was more swollen, more red than before. I recollect one night, when we were playing a round game, I had been looking at her nose very eagerly and sadly for some time. She of herself brought up the conversation about eating, and confessed that she had 5 meals a day. That accounts for it. Says I, flinging down the cards, and springing up and rushing like a madman out of the room. I rushed away into the night, and wrestled with my passion. Hat. Mary, said I, a woman who eats meat 21 times in a week, besides breakfast and tea? Mary, a sarcophagus, a cannibal, a butcher's shop? Away. I strove and strove. I drank, I groaned, I wrestled and fought with my love, but it overcame me. One look of those eyes brought me to her feet again. I yielded myself up like a slave. I fawned and whined for her. I thought her nose was not so very red. Things came to this pitch, that I sounded His Highness's minister to know whether he would give me service in the duchy. I thought of purchasing an estate there. I was given to understand that I should get a chamberlain's key, and some post of honor did I choose to remain, and I even wrote home to my brother Tom in England, hinting a change in my condition. At this juncture the town of Hamburg sent His Highness the Grand Duke a propos of a commercial union which was pending between the 2 states, a singular present. No less than a certain number of barrels of oysters, which are considered extreme luxuries in Germany, especially in the inland parts of the country, where they are almost unknown. In honor of the oysters and the new commercial treaty which arrived in Fergens dispatched for the purpose, His Highness announced a grand supper and ball, and invited all the quality of all the principalities round about. It was a splendid affair. The grand saloon brilliant with hundreds of uniforms, and brilliant toilets not the least beautiful among them, I need not say, was Attilia. At midnight the supper rooms were thrown open, and we formed in 2 little parties of 6, each having a table, nobly served with Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.